Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of Flickers from the Cave. I'm Mike.
And I'm Marty.
On this episode, we will discuss two Italian science fiction epics, The Humanoid, starring Richard Kiel, and Star Crash, starring Carolyn Monroe and Marjo Gortner, and, of course, David Hasselhoff.
And don't forget Max Factor.
And I was going to say Maybelline, but I think that will cover it. More on that later. Thanks for tuning back in, and we hope you're happy to be here.
And we'd like to apologize for the delay. We've both been super busy lately, and it's just taken us a while to get back to the old cave. But we're back.
And it's taken us about, 25 minutes now just to get our connection working on Skype and call burner. So a few technical issues. Apparently the people that did the special effects work for these two films are also handling the audio for this podcast, so that may explain a lot.
That's at least something to hang our hats on there.
Ugh.
But let's start with the first movie.
It's a good thing you didn't mention the disappearance of the Capitron from Grover. If word gets out to the five provinces, there'll be general panic.
Sir, even I haven't been told about Capitron. Is it really so dangerous?
Yes, unfortunately. It was the discovery of the most ingenious scientist that Metropolis has had in this century, Dr. Crespin. It has the power to modify a man's cell structure and transmute him into some sort of monstrosity with superhuman powers.
And the Groban Institute funded this kind of research?
He could do virtually what he wanted. Until Barbara Gibson happened to stumble upon the horrendous results of this new radiation and promptly notified me. Crespin was apprehended, his research stopped, and the Capitron confiscated. He was put away in the mental control satellite, but 2 years ago he was rescued. Nick, we must find out where Crespin's being kept. I suggest you contact Miss Gibson immediately.
All right, sir.
The first movie we're going to talk about is The Humanoid from 1979, directed by Aldo Lotto, starring, like I said, Richard Kiel and a number of other people you probably have not heard of, with the exception possibly of Barbara Bach, Mrs. Ringo Starr, and Arthur Kennedy, who has actually been in a number of fairly reputable and solid genre films, this not being one of them.
Well, the thing is, Richard Kiel, everybody might not know the name, but they, you know, if you've seen any James Bond movies that came out in the 80s, you know who Jaws is. And
yeah, you know the face.
You can't
know him, you love him.
Even his mother doesn't love his face. But in this movie, he plays a good-natured giant of a man named Golub, who is essentially adventuring around the galaxy with his goofy robot dog, and gets sort of mingled and mixed up with some sort of intergalactic plot to conquer things.
That is a perfect description of the plot of this movie.
Yeah, something that doesn't make sense.
And that's disturbing on its own because, it really... You watch this movie, and after 90 solid minutes of somewhat action-packed footage, you still really don't know what the hell everybody was out there trying to accomplish, and it's just the script of this movie rambles worse than I am right now, if that's any indication.
It is frightening.
It is completely frightening.
My favorite character in the movie, I believe, besides the hot woman lead, is this little Asian boy whose name is Tom Tom.
I'm sorry. You've lost Barbara.
Incredible. This has to be some sort of magic. I can't even beat you with a computer that can solve 18 unknowns to the fourth power. Where in Helios did you learn to play so well?
in a place many eons from here.
Well, wherever it was, your amazing skill. Everything about you is a puzzle. You're a mystery to me, Tom Tom.
Why?
Well, you're one of the strangest pupils I've ever been sent. I don't know anything about you. Even your name is mysterious, Lokan Dharma.
Lokaniwa Dharma.
You see? What a name. I can't even pronounce it.
Oh, it means ocean of wisdom, but I like Tam Tam too.
And he is sort of like a Neo character in some ways, and sort of a little bit of a Obi-Wan Kenobi. And so he does all this weird, how would you describe it, just mentalist type stuff? And
oh, he's mental. I think it's safe to say that he is mental on some level.
He and the legendary character Barbara Gibson.
Barbara, yes, the greatest like cinematic moniker in history.
Yeah, that's Barbara a classic. It's right up there with Mr. Smith.
It's dynamic.
So there's this. How do you even? Where do you start with this thing?
I don't know. Now that we're actually sitting here recording this, I'm having a difficult time of quite how to approach it. It's sort of I don't know. How do you handle like an actual smoking turd without getting it on the listener?
Let's try to synopsis this thing. So like the story is there are these two bands. It's essentially your Empire versus your Rebels, but they're not really Rebels. It's more like the good guys and then this splinter group, let's say. So the good guys are led by the Great Brother. This I don't even know if he's altruistic, but he's definitely represented that way. And one of his followers is Barbara Gibson, but it's really funny the way Tom Tom, the little Asian boy, he calls her Barbara. And
Barbara.
She's got far too many syllables in her name than when he comes out of her mouth. But the Great Brother is leading this group, and they're doing all their things that are wonderful and good. And then you've got the evil,
which you have no idea what these things are. They're doing things at a research institute.
Yes.
It's never indicated what it is they are researching or what sort of institute that this research is taking place at.
But it's important.
But it is,
research.
In fact, research. It is vital research pertaining to something of the utmost importance.
I thought it was all just based on making a machine that would smash a round ball of metal into a round circle of metal.
I thought it was to make a machine that goes bing.
Goes ping.
Ping.
And so the evil guy, I think, was it Lord Grawl?
Lord Grawl, who is apparently a... He is a huge fan of Star Wars and deeply into the sadomasochism and bondage and submission community. He's
and maybe hockey,
and possibly hockey.
Yeah. The words do not do justice to his epic helmet.
What about the humanoid? Did he kill the Great Brother?
No, the Great Brother is still alive. He will crush you like a worm.
Take her away.
We've got these two sides led by the Great Brother and Lord Grawl being the bad guy. And Lord Grawl has got this doctor. That's the guy's played by Arthur Kennedy. And Arthur,
yes.
He was doing research on humanoids. Is this correct?
Creating humanoids as unstoppable super soldiers and some research into some sort of Lady Bathory eternal youth.
Yes.
Serum extraction. It did whatever it was that he was developing. It allowed Barbara Bach to maintain some level of stardom until they made Caveman about 3 years after this movie was made.
Welcome to Noxin, my omnipotent lord.
You are more beautiful than I remember, Lady Agatha. One might say time has stopped for you. My compliments, Dr. Crespin. You and my lady have created an extraordinary base of operations.
For you, sire, and your conquest of Metropolis.
Which won't be an easy task. Apart from manpower and equipment, Metropolis also possesses vast nuclear reserves.
My plan is deceptively simple, sire. I shall create for you an army of humanoids. Indestructible human robots.
All I need is a secret element, which I hope you've obtained for me. I have. The attack on the Institute went exactly according to plan.
And the girl? Was she killed?
Unfortunately, Barbara Gibson was not at the Institute when my men attacked. But tell me, why do you hate her so much?
She destroyed years of my work. Committed me to an asylum. Only her death can satisfy me.
I mean, she was a Bond girl.
Exactly.
You know, I didn't think about that until this very moment. That is the linking factor between the two movies that we're talking about. Both of them have a Bond girl.
Oh, that's cool. Well, and Richard Kiel has a Bond.
And Richard Kiel, yes.
Connection.
No, not a girl.
No, and I don't want to see him in a bikini. So,
God, no.
But the so the doctor is keeping Barbara Bach's character, Lady Agatha, young through his nefarious techniques and schemes, and he is wanting to create humanoids. So they need a test case. And who happens to be driving their spaceship by just at that moment but poor Richard Kiel, who is out to do nothing but good and just adventuring with a big smile on his face.
That's just the human I need.
I can't figure out what's wrong. I can't control her, Kip. Strange, like we're being sucked into a magnetic void.
And he is taken hostage and turned into the humanoid of the title. That's accurate. And then he is unstoppable. He is laser-proof at that point, which is interesting, and able to throw dummies and mannequins around like nobody's business.
So watch out, Kim Cattrall.
Yeah. Oh, man, I didn't even think of that. That would be a great sort of sequel, you know, the humanoid meets the mannequin. That would be fantastic.
Although I think the huge number of the people that were in this movie that we're talking about were possibly more wooden than any mannequins you could happen to come across.
The main sort of heroic guy was just so fun to watch as he did what passed for kung fu.
Well, he was such a... he was like channeling Bradford Dillman. and if, I mean, that's... that's an accomplishment. Mm. I mean, if you can be a low rent knockoff of a low rent knockoff, then you're pulling something off. I mean, he's channeling Bradford Dillman, who's channeling Robert Foxworth, who's channeling, I don't know, Christopher George, who's channeling.
Oh, I don't know, Christopher George.
I'll give him props.
That's pretty. That's a good spot.
That may be the place to stop, but still, I mean, like, this guy is like, you know, you've heard of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. This dude's like 6 degrees of Canadian bacon. I mean, he's like...
And you don't mean the John Candy movie.
No. I mean, like, the brown ham that they call bacon.
You said this thing emerged unharmed after laser, neurotoxic, and micronuclear strikes against it?
Yes, sir. He seems indestructible. The nuclear shells only seem to make him stronger.
Then I know this has to be Capitron we're dealing with. What else can you tell me?
Just that during the struggle, one of my men found this.
Item 1X-5A, confirmed ID badge of Metropolis Colony Inspector Gollop, departed 2 years ago, bound for Chloe. First to volunteer, contact lost en route, presumed missing or terminated.
Wait a minute. I've heard of him. He's a big, kind, gentle person.
Not anymore, I'm afraid. That part of him no longer exists.
I want to know who's behind this. We have no enemies outside our galaxy.
I'm afraid the enemy is coming from closer quarters.
But even inside the galaxy.
It can only be Grau.
My brother.
So the one of my favorite things about the movie, beyond Mr. Keel's performance and Tom and his wise ways, was Richard Keel's little robotic dog. And his name was Kip, right? I think it was Kip, the robotic dog.
I thought it was Rex.
No, it was not Rex. Rex, what was that? Wasn't that the name of the dog from Boy Meets Dog?
Ren Tin Tin, or
Wanton Ton,
or you know, Chip Turd.
But the little Kip robotic dog is one of the saddest, most pitiful little things I've ever seen, but it seems to work. I mean, it's clearly, you know, radio controlled. It drives around. Its mouth moves. It makes a pitiful little chirping bark. And Richard Keel loves it dearly.
I shook you up, huh? Yeah, it could be worse. Little silicone tranquilizer will calm you down. I suppose I have to go back and salvage one of those xenophones. So we can send up a distress signal. You know, Kip, you robodogs have quite an advantage over us men. You don't have to fill our reports. See you in a microminute.
It is certainly one of the most endearing things to come out of Radio Shack since the Tandy computer with the
built-in monochrome screen.
And the cassette tape,
yes.
You know, data storage drive.
Man, don't talk about the data storage drive. That was the height of technology.
Hey, when you're storing all your data on like a 30-minute cassette, that's...
Well, as long as you use high-quality cassettes like Centron, yeah, I think you're okay.
Come on, man. Memorex.
I can afford Memorex, man. Centron all the way. It goes at the gas station.
I don't even know what the hell I used back in those days. I was recording the King Biscuit Flower Hour off of the all-night radio station. So
yeah, I was recording Dr. Demento. So
okay, well, there you go.
I knew you were in danger. Come, Barbara.
Thank God you always turn up at the right time.
I'm your best pupil.
And who are those two strangers who saved my life?
They are keepers of an ancient rite.
But how did you... I mean, with the humanoid.
You have nothing to fear from him anymore. He is no longer controlled by anyone.
Tam-Tam. Who are you?
Lokani Wawadharma. Have faith in me. I am here to help you.
So what else would you like to say about this epic masterpiece of cinema?
Well, I think... we would be remiss with, you know, the thing about, if you look through, I actually, as we're talking, I'm looking through the IMDb page. Mm-hmm. There are some remarkably talented people connected with this movie. The truly kind of traumatic.
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. The thing that's just as damning as can be about this movie is.
You're going to mention the music.
Yeah. Ennio Morricone, who has made. So he has done so many good soundtracks. He's done so much great film music over the years. And I don't know what hack paid him to use his name to do this movie, but it is some of the worst music. I have a hard time even calling it music. It's some of the worst sound collage that I can imagine.
It was one of those things after I watched the movie, it does this electronic thing where it starts small and it starts adding elements, much like the Mana Mana song on Sesame Street, but it never gets
Don't drag the Muppets into this.
Well, I think that's the closest sort of analogy I could strike that maybe the listeners would understand, but it keeps building and adding little elements, and I kept waiting for it to get to the point where it had added enough for it to be good, and it never gets there.
Thank you.
I love me some Menomina now.
Well, sure. We all do.
I can't take the comparison.
In fact, in fact, let me stick in a little Menomina right here.
Menomina.
Hi there. Would you like to sing a song with us?
Menomina.
Isn't that the name of a song?
I think so.
Menomina.
Menomina?
Menomina.
Manamana. Manamana. Manamana.
In conclusion, I mean, it's sort of one of those you have to see it to believe it things. The climax, large air quotes around the word climax, to this jewel, consists of a massive battle taking place with hundreds of, well, tens of soldiers shooting it out in an epic epoch of laser violence, and Richard Kiel hurling a single massive steel girder, beheading six soldiers with one blow, and it still manages to be the most underwhelming, boring, dull sequence in the history of cinema. I don't understand how you can blow up so much stuff and still come out with something that is as remarkably uneventful and dull as the climax of this movie turned out to be.
You and I talked about it. I mean, it took me four or five tries to make it through the thing.
It took us, I watched it with my son Dylan, and it took us a couple, and that's with the attention span of an eight-year-old and the fading intellect of a middle-aged man, and it was still all we could do to get through it.
I tried and tried and tried, and it took at least four attempts to finally trudge through the thing.
It was it was painful. Other than that, you know, it's highly recommended.
I don't know if we've spoiled anything by saying there's a big laser shootout at the end. I think that might be self-evident, just, you know, knowing that it's, you know, a science fiction movie. It almost has to end with a big laser shootout.
If we've made it through this review or this evaluation or this
judgment.
Post-mortem, this judgment, yes, this autopsy of a film, and there's anybody listening who still has any inkling of a desire to seek this out and watch it, then I feel no remorse whatsoever revealing the fact that it ends with an epic shootout.
I think after we talk about Star Crash, we can come back to this and maybe talk about some of the reasons somebody might want to watch it. Because I actually have a couple of reasons why I think somebody should watch it.
As opposed to watching Star Crash?
No, I mean as well as Star Crash. I think they have a similar sort of vein to them that would maybe cause someone to search them out.
I will say after we talk about Star Crash, there are things that I will come back to and talk about
yes.
The Human Blade.
So let's move on now to movie number two, Star Crash.
Aha, looks like the cops.
As for Chief of the Imperial Police, I order you to surrender at once.
Full speed!
Stella, you cheap smuggler. I am Police Robot L. You have the right to remain silent. If you give up the ride,
First you gotta catch me, you dirty cop. Go for hyperspace!
Go for it!
Let's hope this star buggy stays together. What's our chances?
40% total disintegration, 30% molecular ignition, 20% gamma contamination.
You're very reassuring. I assume that means we have a 10% chance of making it.
Not really. 3% structural collapse, 2%...
All right. Just keep on course and get ready to re-enter normal...
All right, so Star Crash from 1978, directed by Luigi Cozzi, who has also done a large number of genre films, some of them not nearly as bad as Star Crash. And it stars a cavalcade of fabulous stars. Marjo Gortner, who I really like in a lot of things. Caroline Munro, who is super hot. Christopher Plummer, come on. Oscar nominee, Christopher Plummer. Maybe Oscar winner. I'm not sure. I know he was in everything from the Sound of Music.
Yeah.
And hell, he fathered Amanda Plummer. So this guy's got some chops. David Hasselhoff. The Hoff. Come on. Robert Tessier, who you may not know the name, but you'd know the bald head and the face. Joe Spinell. Maniac. It's just so many wonderful people in it. And the movie is so bad.
Yeah, this is the only thing that I can imagine. The only movie... Luigi Cozzi, who he has done some things that are not ridiculous, but he is the only person I can imagine who could take Robert Tessier and make him seem like an utter and complete pansy. It was like, to me, Robert Tessier is one of these guys that can play a tough guy better than anybody else in any movie. Robert Tessier in The Longest Yard, the original Longest Yard with Burt Reynolds, is... evil or like kind of strength and power incarnate, the character that he plays. Every guard and every prisoner in that movie is terrified of him, and it's completely believable. Here they get the guy that dubbed Mel Gibson from the original release of Mad Max to dub over his voice, and it sounds like it's like Kermit the Policeman.
That's not the goose.
It's just remarkable. And if you, there is no part of me that you can, there's nothing you can do to convince me that Marjo Gortner is going to beat up Robert Tessier in a fight. There is no way.
Yeah, but Marjo Gortner had the power of magic.
How long will the delay be?
I think a very long time. You shouldn't try taking off without asking me first.
This time I'll make sure you're dead. This is it. Say goodbye.
What?
Stop!
Put down the gun.
Stop! No one can survive these deadly rays.
These deadly rays will be your death.
He had the power of some. I think he had the power of Maybelline.
Well, Mr. Tessier, I don't know if you noticed, maybe your color wasn't perfect, but that dude was looking kind of sickly and green.
So he was a pale shade of green, so, yeah. A whiter shade of pale.
Yeah, so I think maybe he was just a little under the weather. But the story of Star Crash is that this woman, Stella Starr, played by Caroline Munro, is some sort of just hellcat out tearing up the galaxy, hauling ass around with her partner, played by Marjo Gortner, who is sort of like
Acton,
not actor.
No, Acton.
But he's got some sort of magical, mystical power. So they're like this team, and they run around and flip off the police and just kind of do what they want.
Yeah, take that, Coppa.
There is some really terrible dialogue in this movie. So.
I'm convinced that if you watch the opening shots of Stella Starr and Acton together in the cockpit of this Star Cruiser they're cruising around in, they must be pumping like some sort of Prozac gas into the. They are the most like blissfully happy star travelers you've ever seen.
Straight up tripping, yeah.
They are straight up tripping, boo, and I've never seen more like they seem to have nothing to do. They're switching knobs and tweaking dials that they seem to have no clue what these things do. It's
you know how in Fight Club Tyler Durden talks about how the oxygen masks that are dropped in an airplane right before the crash are it's purely to kind of quiet the passengers to become like Hindu cows.
To placate them.
Exactly. So maybe that's what's going on inside that space capsule. Maybe there's all this, you know, oxygen in there, and it just kind of has them all chilled out.
Maybe. I think it may be that Acton is wearing a tighter thong than Stella is, and both of them are in such a state of genital restrictions that they can't think straight or something. I don't know. I have no explanation.
The outfits they put Stella Starr in are quite spectacular too.
That's the really if you're gonna seek this movie out, that's the reason.
Well, the thing is though. I mean, it's not Barbarella level of super hotness or anything, but it's funny to me. I never thought she was super hot in her little outfits, but I mean, I like Barbarella, where it's just scary hot. But there was some funny stuff when Stella is sentenced to the prison planet and she's in her thigh high boots and bikini. It was
if you'd have slapped that outfit on like Paul Newman and forced him to eat like 50 boiled eggs,
be a little different.
Wearing thigh high leather boots and a leather bikini.
It would have been
a different movie. It
would have been more than just a failure of communication.
And I tell you one thing, George Kennedy would have called him his boy then, for sure.
Yeah, they wouldn't even have looked at that warden's daughter over there washing that car.
Oh, no, 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 no.
But in Star Crash, she is probably, I guess, was there a competing hot woman in the movie?
Cause no.
In Humanoid,
only,
there was the two.
The only competing hot woman in Star Crash is David Hasselhoff.
True. And well, I don't want to say who he is because at the end it's sort of a twist reveal. Oh, now I've spoiled it. But no, yeah. I won't say.
Again, you know, I'm going to have to fall back on the same logic I applied to the Humanoid. If anybody is like bulldoze through this review enough to have any desire to see this, I think it's okay.
I think anybody that is our age, which is, you know, early to mid-40s, who grew up reading Starlog magazine, if you didn't see this movie, you probably somewhere in the back of your mind always wanted to, because that was the case for me. I mean, I didn't see it until maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I was desperate to see it. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. If somebody had told me it sucked, I still would have been, well, I still want to see it, because I gazed at those pages of Starlog so many times, and I wanted to see it so badly.
His Highness, the Emperor of the First Circle of the Universe.
I come to you because my faithful robot, El, has told me that you are the only one who can save us. You know, you must be the best pilot in the whole galaxy. And you, Acton, the best navigator, Stella. Our galaxy is split into two warring factions, our own and the one ruled by the evil Count Zarthan from the League of the Dark Worlds. Recently begun to receive troublesome reports from our spies among the League. They have informed us that the Count has created a weapon. A new, limitless weapon. A weapon so vast, so huge, that it would take a whole planet to conceal it.
Let's cover some of these characters. We have Christopher Plummer as the Emperor, basically, of space.
He is the Emperor of...
Of all.
Of all cosmetics.
He's like the king of Cartoon Land or something.
I tell you what, he wears as much eyeliner as Gortner and Hasselhoff.
I think it was just whoever the makeup person was in this, just, you know, maybe had some kind of, like, a lot of the samples from the, you know, their sales rep. So they definitely
all the men wear more than Carolyn Monroe. That's the scary part.
Maybe that's the idea. That's their idea of the future, is that men become like the peacocks and the women have become more sort of, you know, secondary.
Well, you had to put P in front of it.
Well, you have to. So you've got the good guy, the Emperor, Christopher Plummer, and then you've got the bad guy, Count Zarth Arn, played by Mr. Joe Spinell.
You've been very lucky and clever. You survived every trap that I'd laid for you. Then I realized that your success would become my triumph. How much time is left, Captain?
Half a quadrant to go, my lord.
You hear? In less than an hour's time, all that will be left of this planet will be ashes and cosmic dust. Forever. Then... you will be among the dead.
The Emperor will make you pay for this.
The Emperor? I forgot to inform you that the Emperor will be blown to pieces along with the rest of you.
I decided watching this, he is the Ron Jeremy of genre filmmaking.
That is a good analogy. Yeah, that is a good analogy. He is the hedgehog of genre.
He's the horror hedgehog.
Horror hog. I like that.
The horror hog.
Oh, man. Don't be using that word too many times, because you're going to get some shitty, like, horror remake film thing coming out here soon from, like, the dude that made Hatchet.
Do you think, was he dubbed?
I couldn't tell 100%. I mean, it wasn't like Harvey Keitel in Saturn 3.
Well, nothing is like Harvey Keitel in Saturn 3, but I really wonder if he was dubbed.
I think maybe he wasn't, or if he was Foley'd in, it was him who did the Foley work, because it sounded like him, but it sounded like a very effete, very overacting sort of version of him.
I think that, John, what's his name from Saturday Night Live?
John Lovitz.
John Lovitz may have dubbed him. I don't know. It was like master thespian level dubbing.
Was it Emperor Todd from Mom and Dad?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It was Emperor Todd level. Emperor Todd was way scarier.
I want to watch that again.
Than this guy. It's really good.
Yeah, I love that.
Mom and Dad Save the World, by the way. That's something that I have yet had a chance to show my kids, and I am anxious.
I have it on VHS, but...
I need to find a DVD of that, and I got to find a DVD of Galaxy Quest.
I have a DVD of Galaxy Quest. I can loan.
I got to show my kids some good, funny sci-fi.
Well, those would both be good choices. So in Star Crash, you've got. Let's go back to that real quick. So we got the Caroline Monroe character and her partner Acton, and they are adventuring around the galaxy, doing bad. Well, not doing bad, but doing sort of. You know, a lot of pranks and stuff, sort of just being, you know.
That's right. They leave a bag of, like, burning Klingon turds on the steps of the Imperial City.
And for that, they must pay.
They must pay.
So they are sent to, like, a prison planet, not led by Alex Jones. And they're forced to work in the mines for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, don't you think, before they're...
Or, as the sentence goes in the movie, 250 years.
The great machines of the central operating system of Imperial Justice hereby sentence you, Acton of Nine Vega, to 220 years hard labor in the prison planet of Seacom III. As for you, Stella Star, having considered all the arguments, studied all the videotapes, the accusations, we condemn you to forced labor for life in the penal colony of Nocturne II. This session is hereby adjourned.
Which does amount to 6.5 or 7 minutes of screen time. It's long enough for a good costume change and for some red shirts to die in a fiery laser battle.
That's right, and lava. There's some lava in the distance, I think, but I can't remember. So they're broken out for some reason by the forces of good, which doesn't make sense. It seems like the governor could have just sent in a pardon. But they're like forcibly released under their own recognizance, and they're sent to try to find the survivors of a lost spaceship?
Mm-hmm. A number of lost shuttles off of the Imperial fleet. And because Drake was too clever for the fleet. Sorry.
So that's what they're sent to do, because they're such masters of hauling ass around the universe, I guess. So they're sent on a mission. And punking. That's right. They were just like poning people left and right.
It's intergalactic punking. That's what this movie needed, was some ass and Kutcher.
It had Acton, but it didn't have Ashton. So
it needed Ashton, exactly. If Margaret Gordner had been Ashton,
the shit would have been.
And they could have got it would have been totally real. They could have got a little Canon quick shot camera
and given him a trucker hat, and it would have been on. So you've got this movie. They go off to do their adventures, and they end up getting embroiled in much excitement. And I say that as sincerely as I can.
Which is, I would imagine...
zero sincerity.
Not very sincere.
But it's still... we'll get to this more. But, like, this movie had music by John Barry, who has done brilliant music.
Now, what else has he done? I don't know what John, I will say, though, I guess because I had the brilliant Ennio Morricone score for The Humanoid in the back of my mind as I watched this.
Right.
This was actually pretty decent music.
Well, he's definitely, you know, a solid dude. I mean, Jesus, I just went to his page and he's got 114 credits, including a James Bond movie. So there's another connection. Several James Bond movies, including Goldfinger and From Russia with Love and, oh God, I'm sure there's more.
How did they get this guy?
They said, we're doing a movie. Here's some money. And he said, okay. That's all it takes.
Oh, apparently.
But anyway, I mean, the special effects were passable at spots. And I don't know. It had actors. It had people. It had good stuff going on in general. It just was so Italian. It was so plodding.
the irony of the whole thing is I thought that, like, the special effects and the model work in the humanoid were in a way far superior to Star Crash. I think that the way the models were filmed looked a lot better in the humanoid. There was something about there's a whole trick to filming models as far as giving them a sense of scale and making them move in such a way that it has some feel of the size, everything moving right and seeming and like that was completely lacking in Star Crash. Like these models moved like they had some 9-year-old kid who had missed his Ritalin working the servo motor that closed up the fist of pain that was Joe Spinell's headquarters.
Oh, that's right.
In the climax there. So it just moved in such a kind of spastic, overly fast way that there was no scale to it.
See, I think you just don't understand just how fast these fists of pain of the future will be able to close.
Well, apparently not. And another thing I don't understand is how in Star Crash, like, apparently all these spacecraft are equipped with the greatest anti-lock brakes that you can put on a starship.
They're like air brakes, I think.
These things were like the thing where they surround their ship. The police tell Stella and Acton that they are surrounded. Right. And these ships, I was fully expecting for one of the starships to squeal its tires the way the Dukes of Hazzard would squeal on a dirt road. You know, apparently the Foley budget lacked the, they didn't have that one sound effect.
Oh, me. Water makes me so nervous.
Everything makes you nervous. It's the launch. Let's land.
Okay, taking it easy. Shuttle the starship. We are landing now. Roger out. My seatbelt stuck.
Oh, L, come on.
Take it easy, I'm coming. Look at that.
Amazing. It's almost buried.
The impact was tremendous. I doubt if anyone could have survived. The nuclear exhaust ports have been gutted by fire.
We'd better look around. What's that? Seems to be a planetary artifact.
Well, it certainly is an antique.
Looks like some sort of laser sphere.
This planet is inhabited. We must be very careful. We are in the evil count's domain.
I do think that there's something to be recommended in both of these, but it's, you know, I think it takes a little digging. It's not clear right on the top that there's any reason in the world for anybody to search either of these movies out.
I will say if you're gonna watch these, the digging that you have to do, you have to dig far into the back of the cooler case where the coldest beer is, because it's going to take at least a six pack
and a weekend, because you're not going to make it all the way through in one go.
Exactly. By the time you drink enough beer to appreciate the attributes of either one of these movies, there's a good chance you're just going to pass out on the sofa.
And then repeat the next day.
Right. It's like shampoo. It's sort of a watch, lather, repeat kind of situation.
Except instead of dirt and stuff washing down the drain, it's actually your brain cells. So,
yeah, and like big Italian turds.
Your Highness.
Yes, Elric?
An entire space fleet is approaching this fortress.
What? Call in all our forces immediately. We will wipe out the Emperor completely. By sunset, I'll be the new Emperor. And I will be the master of the whole universe.
You were talking about the model work and stuff, and I mean, I think both of them had very similar, you know, spaceship model work. I think Star Crash was subpar below humanoid, but I also thought that both really had nice scale model work, both like sort of the installations and stuff in the humanoid and the crashed spaceships and stuff in Star Crash. I thought a lot of that stuff was really well done.
Particularly the thing on in Star Crash where they find the wreck on the beach.
Right.
Looked really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it was well done.
And I think he also, like in Star Crash, it's much more stylized. Like it is that sort of Barbarella type of look with things being all rounded and shiny and glass and no real obvious understanding of how it operates. The little pod that they take from the ship down to the planet is just a glass, you know,
box.
Yeah, it's, or I was going to say suppository is what it kind of looks like.
Well, it looked like the elevator from Mall of America.
Or from, it doesn't even look as good as like the Willy Wonka elevator from the Wonkavator.
No.
But it's still, it's, I think it's an interesting direction that they went. I just think it's unfortunate that it was in this movie, you know.
Well, one of the interesting things to me was that it was very much like there was something about the style of it that put me in the mind of like the original Flash Gordon serials.
Mm-hmm.
There's a level of kind of innocence and silliness and just sort of gee golly kind of mentality that somehow if you took the interior decorator from Studio 54 in 1978 and had him design the Flash Gordon serials from the 30s,
right,
that's kind of what you would have. It had this real kind of disco colored light, chrome and metal aesthetic combined with a level of just sort of wide-eyed innocence that you would get from the serials. No part of it that seemed even remotely, when you think about the fact that this came out concurrently with Star Wars or God forbid, Alien, where there was an earthiness and a hardness to the sci-fi. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You go back and look at Silent Running or 2001. I mean, you know, this made Forbidden Planet look like hard science sci-fi.
We have things like Logan's Run that came out at about that time, didn't it?
Yeah, that's true. That's a great thing to bring up because Logan's Run has that same sort of...
It's just kind of cheesy in its effects and stuff, but it's still a great movie with a great story.
And so much better storytelling and acting.
Well, yeah. I mean, it clips along. It's got something to do. It's not this plotting, just sort of, why are we doing this? What's going on? Sort of thing like these. Both of these Italian movies have.
It's an interesting thing to look at the Italian films.
I mean, you have so many masters. I mean, you have people like, Sergio Leone, who can make brilliant movies, like the best in their class, but... and then you've got all these other just, I don't want to say hacks, because they've done a lot of things I enjoyed, but wow, it's just
well, but you've got, I mean, palatable. You have to look, you've got early Dario Argento. I mean, everything that Dario Argento did up until, Tenebrae. It's all brilliant, with the exception of some of the stuff from Inferno, which is mind-numbingly bad. I mean, it's visually brilliant, but Liam McCluskey is still the worst piece of crap actor in the history of cinema. He's pretty bad. He slapped some eyeshadow on him. He could have been in Star Crash. Well, he would have been a good one in Star Crash.
He would have been a good one. I guess if Marjo Gortner had been busy, maybe he would have been in it.
Yeah. If you got him in there in the Robert Tessier role, everybody would have had really nice hair.
Would have been fabulous.
Fabulous. What was the Vidal Sassoon could have got on board with Maybelline to sponsor this film?
It would have just been like their ship name, the SS Maybelline.
Exactly. The SS Cosmetique.
Oh, man. That would have been awesome. It would have been like Vegas in space. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am not.
You look that one up when you get a moment. I'm not going to go into it here, but it's a... It's basically what you're saying, except slightly more homosexual. So, I have a copy. I'll loan it to you. So,
we'll see.
So, if you've gotten to this point and you're wondering, like, why in the world are they talking about these two movies? I mean, is this just a warning? Is this just a flare burning on the side of the road saying, "Take the Canyon Road. Do not go any further this way"? But there was something in both of these movies that sort of struck me, and it was, as you said earlier, it was just a sense of innocence and fun. And I think both of these movies really, really meant well, and not just like some young kid who draws a picture and it's not very good, but you want them to feel good about it, so you hang it on the refrigerator. What I'm talking about is a thing where people, enough of the people I think in both of these movies cared, and they were really putting their own little spin on things. That as bad as it was, I was never offended or angry at the movies. It was just sort of goofy, good-natured stuff. I would grade it like I would grade a fourth grade drama presentation.
I will say I had less trouble maintaining consciousness during Star Crash.
Yes, I only drifted once for like a split second.
I have to say that maybe it's the editing of Star Crash. There was a little bit more going on that would keep you engaged as a viewer.
I think it was John Barry's score. I think his score was enough to keep you interested, where the Ennio Morricone thing just did nothing for me.
That definitely could be part of it. I mean, music is such a... I mean, we've talked about this before, but watching like a work print of a movie where there's no music,
right?
It's such a completely different experience, and I think good music as opposed to bad music, that would be sort of an interesting experiment, is to go back and take something like Extra... And put a good score on it and see if it made it a better movie. And it may well make it a better movie.
I think that would just be a polished turd is all that would be. But
well, it might be, but you know, it would be an interesting experiment.
I'd watch Extra again.
I would too.
I'd like to watch it with the filmmaker, though.
Yes, like a audio commentary track.
Yes.
I mean, the interview post Extra interview absolutely was more entertaining than the movie.
Oh, man. That was more entertaining than a lot of movies I've seen.
Yeah, I agree.
But some of the things that I really found appealing, Star Crash in particular had the most colorful space that I've ever seen. The stars were all blues and reds and yellows and bright greens. It looked like a Christmas tree backdrop. I'm sure a lot of times in these movies they use, you know, Christmas lights against a black velvet background, but they're all white. So it just sort of, you know, disappears in the back and they look like little stars. But in these, you were meant to see them, and they were it's just such a colorful rainbow of stars. It was very pretty. And the spaceships were similarly lit with very bright colors.
A lot of the lighting of the model work was very colorful too, which was, it gave it a slightly cartoony comic book feel.
Well, and the soft focus on the people and the, I don't know, the cheesy dialogue. It just seemed very much, I think your description of it as like a 1940s serial, you know, is pretty accurate.
Yeah, that's completely what it put me in the mind of. And I'm still on the fence as far as whether I think that's a compliment or not.
Well, I think there's something to be found there in both of these, though. And I think as good-natured as Star Crash was, I think the humanoid is even got a sweeter heart to it. It's just, I don't know, there was something very winning about the Tom character and Barbara and Golob. There was something so likable about all those characters, and I don't know, I found myself pulling for them, you know, even though I couldn't stay awake for it. When I would be awake, I would be pulling for them.
As soon as I wake up, I'm going to root for you to win.
That's right. I hope when I wake up, you're not dead.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt, too.
I don't want to spoil it, but, you know, let's just say maybe they were dead. Maybe they weren't.
Maybe not. Yeah. You never know.
That's right. Well, you know, people die, don't they?
That's right. You got a nice army base here, Colonel.
Well, tanks burn,
don't they? That's right.
So I will leave my very favorite line from Star Crash as the ending soundbite. I will not say what it is, but when you hear it, you will be. I think you might.
Imperial Starship.
Stop it! Don't spoil it. But it'll. I think when the listeners hear it, they're going to be like, "Where can I get a copy of this movie now?" I believe it did just come out on Blu-ray.
I will think that when the listeners hear that, they will think, "Why could that not have happened 5 minutes into this movie?"
Man,
I could have saved 90 minutes of my precious life.
I do urge everyone to drop their $18 and pick this bad Mamma Jamma up.
If there's a Brown Ray, I think is what it's been released on.
It took a second. I was like, yeah, what like, the hell is he
Turd Ray video.
You have to watch it in the toilet.
That's right, exactly. Just fling the disc into the loo.
So have we eviscerated these things enough, you think?
I think so. I think they are thoroughly eviscerated.
If this was Siskel and Ebert and I were one of those, I would probably be giving both of them a hesitant and reserved thumbs up.
I think if I could make a fist out of my foot, I would use my big toe to make something in a semi-vertical position.
So not straight up.
Not straight up. Maybe if I could actually fold four of my toes down and have my middle toe stand directly upright, I would do that.
If you were rating this on the Hustler rating scale, which goes from fully rigid to totally flaccid,
I would give
chubby, sort of.
For Star Crash, I would say semi-chubby.
Sort of a whiskey dick.
Exactly. That's about 13 beers in. And for the humanoid, I mean, you know, I like Richard Kiel and all, but that's going to be pretty flaccid, I'm afraid. It's just not enough there for me. I don't know.
You know, it would be a good rating system, not the Hustler rating system, but the sort of how altered does my consciousness need to be to find this pleasing.
Okay, then we'll go with the humanoid, a hefty shot of Thorazine.
All right, I can see that. I don't know. I think maybe like something that would might up you a little bit because you're going to be, you know, comatose anyway from the damn movie, so.
That's true. You might want to go for some, like,
some ecstasy or something.
Some Leonard Bilden cooked meth.
Just watch out if your pigs are stealing your stuff.
Is your hogs on meth? How would you know? How could you tell? That clip, by the way, is on YouTube. I recommend highly that everybody goes and watches that.
That clip from Squidbillies?
Yes, early Kyler telling you how to know if your hog is on drugs.
That's why if you're watchedization of your Star Crash DVD, that's how you tell.
gibberish style ornery, what don't make no sense at all.
So we're saying that humanoid requires some sort of
electroshock treatment
and amphetamine of some sort in order to keep you awake.
Yeah,
right. All right. And Star Crash
requires
maybe just something to chill you right out
and a lubricant.
So those are the two films from this episode 5
of Flickers from the Cave.
We thought that after the episode 4, which we covered the wonderful My Dinner with Andre, that we needed to maybe get back down in the dirt a little bit.
And boy did we!
Boy did we! This was this was more than slumming. This was like going underneath the slum down into the sewer.
Yeah, exactly.
It was like the only thing we had to worry about here was were chuds.
Yes, exactly. Cinematic humanoid underground dwellers.
And the only person that could have saved us was Inspector
Bosch.
There we go.
Who was coincidentally was played by Christopher Curry.
If you didn't know.
If you didn't know that, go back and listen to a previous episode because you weren't paying attention.
We will straighten your ass out.
Straighten you out real good.
So I guess that's all we've got for now.
I think I'm spent.
All right.
I need to go have a nap.
You need some Thorazine.
I need whatever it is I need to make it through the next showing of the humanoid.
Oh, man. Are you planning a neighborhood showing?
No, I have to live in this neighborhood. That's a surefire way to get evicted.
They burn a big Richard Kiel effigy in your front yard.
That's right. Burn an H in your front yard.
Oh, man. Well, if you had the Imperial Starship, you know.
You could stop. All right, then. All right.
So thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you for listening.
We'll be back soon, I hope.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
The Count has mined the planet with nuclear charges. We're all about to die.
You know something, my boy? I wouldn't be emperor if I didn't have some powers at my command.
Imperial battleship! Halt! The flow of time!
In the space of 3 minutes, every molecule on this planet will be immobilized. But after the third minute, the green ray loses its power. Time will flow once again, and everything will explode.